Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
You can't beat the sound of a contented cat. That's why veterinary surgeon and natural pet food pioneer John Burns developed Burns Pet Nutrition. Because he knows the positive impact a natural diet has on our beloved pets. And our premium cat food is designed to satisfy even the most finicky eaters. For natural, no nasty, wholesome recipes, choose Burns Pet Nutrition. Available from veterinary clinics and all good pet shops across Ireland.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, limited availability remains in Belfast at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
I'd say the man was almost slightly traumatized, a bit of post-traumatic stress disorder from what you're facing in that moment. It's like a ball going around a roulette machine. It's going to land on black or red. Yeah. You're either going to be put away for the rest of your life and probably die in prison, never see your family. They can come visit you, but there's going to be a screen dividing them. Or you're going to feel freedom like you've never felt before.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
It's a year to the day that Jerry the Monk Hutch walked free from the Special Criminal Court after he was found not guilty of the murder of David Byrne at the Regency Hotel. So what has it been like a year on from those dramatic events? And what has the veteran criminal been doing since he tasted freedom once again? Today, I'm talking with Niall Donald about the monk and the day that his chips came in. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com.
So this time last year, Jerry the Monk Hutch walked out the front door of the CCJ building and was an incredible moment. I even managed to get myself on photographs all over the world as I was part of the Jackals to greet him as he walked out the door. But he walked out and straight away there were stories about what was going to happen to him next, including fears for his safety or going to be arrested as part of further operations. But you've been looking into how a year of freedom has gone for the monk.
I suppose I've been trying to, you know, piece together a little bit from people who might know him and who might chat to him about what it was like in the run-up to that day and in the aftermath. You know, Jerry Hutch has been asked for interviews by many people, including myself. I'm not sure he's ever going to sit down and do an interview for a number of reasons. Probably, you know, first and foremost, because he probably couldn't speak too freely for fear of it coming back to bite him in a way. You know what I mean? I think he's had a few little interactions with the media over the years, but
Yeah, I mean, he did an interview with RTE at the time, but I suppose you get to this point where you're going to ask him about crimes and he's going to have to deny everything. So maybe it's ultimately a frustrating...
Yeah, probably a frustrating process for both sides in a way, you know what I mean? And given what happened to him, I'm sure he doesn't particularly want to be back in the dock again.
No.
You know? Jeopardy, like, but...
Like this time last year... Do you think he, from what you've, the people you've been talking to, he was expecting to walk out the courts this day last year?
Well, I think he would tell friends that he knew he should.
Yeah.
Because he felt there was no case against him. Look, we sat and heard Jonathan Dowdall's evidence and
he did too. He had read those transcripts before it ever went to court. And I think his feeling was that there was nothing in them that was going to incriminate him. As regards the charge, which he was, there was one charge put to him, which was murder and nothing else. So I think I always found it interesting, you know, how he got on in the run up to that day, because you could feel the pressure.
You could.
Like,
I mean,
he was, so Gerry Hutch was 60, I think, a few weeks or, even maybe 10 days before the verdict or a week before the verdict.
Yeah.
And he celebrated that birthday in prison.
Yeah.
Where he was, had been on remand for, was it 18 months?
Something like that, yeah.
He had been arrested in Spain and extradited back to Ireland on this murder charge. He's not a guy that has been in prison much since he was a younger man. And I did wonder how he'd kind of got on and how he'd coped with it. And I think he was very determined that he, you know, was going to face down, put up a good defence on this charge. I suppose a lot of that year was caught up in meeting with his legal team, putting together the defence. And obviously then at the last hour when Jonathan Dowdall went state witness, they would have had to scramble again and work out what was going to happen there.
Because, I mean, of course, it happened very, very late, didn't it? I mean, it was sort of unprecedented that the fact that Jonathan Dowdall was going to be a state's witness was only just made known just as the trial was about to start. I mean, Gerry Hutch had been kept, normally when prisoners are on remand awaiting trial, they're kept in either Clover Hill, one of those remand prisons. But Gerry Hutch, of course, was in Wheatfield in Dublin for all of that time. But he would have been allowed extra visits with lawyers and all of that, presumably.
Sharing a wing with Jonathan Dowdall.
Yes.
A couple of cells up from him, you
know.
Yeah. So a very bizarre situation. And I think he sort of has said to people he knows that he kind of knew it was coming with Dowdall.
Yeah.
I think Hutch is somebody who isn't a drug taker. Like, he just isn't a drug taker. So he was in prison, he was a little bit of a lone figure, because a lot of the other people he was sharing the prison with were taking drugs, and they were kind of, I suppose, off their heads a lot of the time, whereas he wasn't.
Yeah.
So he tried to keep himself as active as possible, and he would have been maybe given an extra little bit of time in the exercise yard on his own, because nobody else really wanted to be out there.
Yeah.
They were all in their cells. So it must have been a strange place for him. I think he read and he did as much as he could to keep himself occupied. And of course, there was this huge thing waiting for him, which was the Regency trial.
Yeah.
So the trial gets going, and obviously that keeps you occupied if you're a prisoner. Yeah. You're being transported up and down every day.
Yeah. Which is, there's that, and there was elaborate security around his movements as well. It wouldn't have even, would have been even more, probably taken more time and more. So there would have been a full day then during those court hearings, presumably.
Yeah, and obviously you're listening intently if you're the guy in the dock facing the murder charge. And the big looming thing was Christmas. Was it going to finish before Christmas? And of course it didn't, because it was a 52-day trial. So it went on past the Christmas. And that, you know, you would have expected was something that was a lonely time, I suppose, in prison over Christmas, or sort of a family man like him. And but I think that he has said to friends that on reflection, he felt it was good to get a bit of time for everybody to get a bit of time out from it. It was so intense that the break over Christmas was a good thing. And then it came back, of course, and it finished up around the end of January, the trial. It was 140 witnesses, 10 hours of the secret audio recordings, 8 days of Jonathan Dowdall on the stand, the phone call data, the hours of the CCTV footage, 27 National Surveillance Unit officers, and 4 closing speeches, like an enormity.
Yeah.
And at that point, at the end of January, there was a date given for the 17th of April for the verdict.
Yeah. I mean, and normally, of course, it's totally different than a normal jury murder trial, because a jury murder trial, as soon as all the closing speeches end, you're really, a jury is going to come back in 3 to 4 days maximum. Mm. I mean, I don't think they go on really past 4 or 5 days ever in the history of the state. And they just come back with a verdict, guilty or not guilty. But this is different because it's the Special Criminal Court. So, you know, they have that delay, which is unusual, really. I mean, it's normal in the Special Criminal Court, but otherwise it's unusual, because the judges don't come back and just say guilty or not guilty. They come back with guilty or not guilty, and here is why, with a big long document, which did come back.
Yes, on the 17th of April.
Yeah.
So the day before that, I always felt that must have been, I mean, the pressure of that. So if you consider that here's a man who has, look, he's known as a criminal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's known, he was described in the court as the head of the Hutch organized crime group, as a sort of paternal father figure of the family and all the rest of it. But he's a man who's reached 60 with very little jail time and with a very sort of interesting life that many of us don't know a huge amount about. But he's also a family man, and he's looking down the barrel of 25 years at least in prison.
100%.
If convicted.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly never getting out till probably he's 80 years old, except for given medical circumstances that might get him out earlier. Yeah. Like, but really, the end of his like the end of his life.
The end of his life. Like, so that must be a huge amount of pressure for anybody. But he would say to friends now that he sort of tried his best to keep positive, that he was very nervous. He had this crazy beard and crazy hair, and he was asked if he wanted to have that, you know, tamed, I suppose, or cut in prison for the verdict. And he said that, you know, he felt, what was the point at that stage? Yeah. The judges had made their decision and his haircut wasn't going to change
No.
And he also sort of has told friends that he reckoned that if he was going to get his hair cut, he wanted to get it cut in the Grafton barber and not in prison, you know?
And when when he walked out that door, like it was really unusual, wasn't it? Because like we were there, obviously, and all the reporters were there, and most people, I think, expected that he'd be in some way secreted out or maybe brought out the back door or have some sort of arrangement. And it seemed really chaotic, didn't it? Considering what was at stake and all the attention, all the international media attention. Do we know that he had any plan there, or did it just sort of unfold as it unfolded?
Well, that is what he has told friends was exactly his plan.
Yeah.
That if he got off and he was found not guilty, he was walking out the front door as a free man.
Yeah.
And I suppose he's always valued his freedom in Dublin.
Yeah.
Hopping on and off a Lewis, hopping on and off a bus. People have always seen him walking up and down where we are on Talbot Street. He's regularly walking along with a friend, chatting. He's known to go out to local pubs to kind of have coffees in, you know, local places around here when he's in the city. And I think that's what he valued and wanted to do. He wanted to walk out. Now, he probably would have been better hopping on the bloody Lewis, wouldn't
he?
He
probably would have been. Well, maybe not the Lewis, but he definitely, a bit more planning might have been. But I mean, it was unique.
Because of course, to remind anybody who forgot, what happened was, of course, he was found not guilty. He didn't show a huge amount of emotion, I don't think, in the courtroom. He met downstairs in the round room of the CCJ with his solicitors. There was a taxi ordered for him at some point, whether that was on his phone or somebody else ordered it. As is typical of a Dublin taxi driver, the call came, "I'm outside."
Yeah.
So out walked Gerry Hutch, but the taxi driver was the far end of Phoenix Park.
Exactly. "I'll be there in 2 minutes" was didn't suit at this stage. And of course, then there was the famous moment where the guy who became known as his bodyguard sort of appeared on the scene and sort of acted as his protector. And people obviously were thinking, who is this guy? Gerry doesn't look like their typical security officer, let's put it that way. So that all added to the dramatic moment. But if you think back to that day, there was loads of articles, obviously he's found not guilty, but then there was loads of articles saying, as journalists always do, you give the verdict and then you have to predict what's next. And what was being predicted and what has happened, I suppose, in that year since he's walked out?
So what was being predicted was he was going to go into hiding, wasn't it? And you know, he was going to be running for his life and scared and all. And I think he showed the very opposite of that, because instead he definitely stayed in Dublin for a period of time. And there was photographers employed for weeks on end to try and grab snaps of him here, there and everywhere.
The first picture of him without his beard.
All this sort of stuff. Yeah. And you know, he...
Which we published, so we're not looking down on those pictures. We're not knocking them.
Washed in the blood of the lamb here, but he went home to his house in Clontarf and he had a party.
Yeah.
And his neighbours were invited, and then there was a big huge blow up because some
Yeah, not to get into all that, but then there was...
somebody from the ombudsman or something.
Yeah, there was a GSOC officer arrived at the...
That blew up and blew down again as quick, didn't it?
It did, but I mean, it was one of those goo-boo events, suppose, you know, as happened in Ireland, where these unbelievable events seem to occur around big stories. But yeah, it sort of... there was a resignation and things have moved on. But he did, he stayed in Clontarf, I suppose, quite visibly in the immediate aftermath. I think most people expected that he would go to Spain, where he has spent a lot of time in recent years. He did obviously ultimately head off to Spain.
He did, but I don't think he went too quick. I think he hung around for a period of time that maybe even the media got bored of him hanging around. I mean, I remember you and I saw him going down Tob Street one day, you know, shooting the breeze with some fella, and he was just wandering along. And, you know, he was spotted here, there, and everywhere. There was a period of time, I think, when members of the public were sort of seeing him and kind of contacting you, and, oh, I saw him. Yeah. Okay, well, he's a free man. But I suppose I was interested to know kind of, and to find out as much as I possibly can, what was going on, really, because that was the public, Jerry Hutch, who was, you know, holding his head up, I suppose, going back into his community, because he would always sort of say to friends as well, he moved to Clontarf years ago and reared his family there, but he is a North Inner City man at his heart, and that's his community, and that's where he feels most at home, and he's in Ireland. But I think what was going on personally, or what he certainly sort of, you know, told people, is that he just sort of kicked back, and he was almost like, look, I'd say the man was almost slightly traumatized, a bit of post-traumatic stress disorder from what you're facing in that moment. You know, you've got, it's like a ball going around a roulette machine. It's going to land on black or red. Yeah. You're either going to be put away for the rest of your life and probably die in prison, never see your family sort of in the same way again. They can come visit you, but there's going to be a screen dividing them and whatever else, or you're going to feel freedom like you've never felt before.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what happened. And I think for the first 6 months, he seems to have really enjoyed that freedom. And the simple things, hopping on a bus, getting off a bus, looking around, you know, going for a walk, enjoying a pint. Friends would say that he let himself enjoy everything he wanted.
Yeah.
And he had, in prison, because I suppose he wasn't living that lifestyle that other inmates were, what he could enjoy in prison was whatever food he wanted. So he would be usually very kind of fit and conscious of that. And I think he'd put on a little bit of weight, and he continued over the 6 months to maybe concentrate on just having an ice cream when he wanted an ice cream, having a pint when he wanted it.
Of course, the nickname the Monk comes back to the Veronica Guerin days, doesn't it? Where he was described as opposed to his contemporaries, he was lived like a monk. He didn't drink or smoke or take drugs. And of course, that's always been less true than people think, hasn't it? Like, he does.
Well, he certainly takes a pint. I've no idea. I don't think he smokes, or certainly he doesn't nowadays. Yeah. And I'm not sure about the drugs thing.
No.
I certainly don't think...
No, he's not.
He's an addict.
Yeah.
He certainly has no sort of addiction issues with drugs. But I think he did that sort of for the first 6 months and really enjoyed Christmas, enjoyed the simple things again of Christmas, probably sitting with your family and having a meal. And, but I mean, also carrying all that grief and trauma that went with the last decade of his life, which has included the murder of his brother, who he was very close to, Eddie Hutch, in the days after the Regency Hotel. And I think he was very close to Eddie. I don't know about the other brothers or how...
No, I think he was close to them all. I mean, his other brother, John, Johnny Hutch, died. Not a murder. He died. He fell down the stairs, I think, and died in a tragic accident. And obviously then, Jerry Hutch has also lost his nephews, Gary Hutch, Garrett Hutch, and Derek Coakley Hutch.
Three nephews.
So he's also lost...
And two friends. Noel Duggan and Noel Kerwin.
Yeah. So, I mean, he has all of that around him, you know, that grief and that... You know, and also, of course, then, do you think then that that has made him feel security conscious? Do you think that he does he feel that risk to him being killed or other members of his family has gone? Or
don't know.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I don't know. I'm sure he doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm sure he certainly has got used to living looking, you know, over his shoulder all the time, and he's probably a lot of them should.
Yeah.
If they haven't, they should get used to that. They probably have, in fairness.
Yeah.
I mean, they've had years of it, and definitely, look, the threat has abated.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. The threat level here in Dublin over a number of times, certainly in the first 2 years after the Regency, was deemed a critical threat level. And that's the same threat level that would be in place if there was a terrorist risk.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, that is as high as it gets. So that has been in place in Dublin. But of course, we don't know much about where Gerry Hutch went in those years, because he wasn't back here in Dublin. If he was, he was probably staying in the north inner city in homes where he felt safe. I don't know, was he back in the country? He certainly went off the radar for a long time. It appears he was travelling and he was lying low.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a long time that he was doing that. And of course, when he was arrested, he was with his wife, I think, wasn't he? In Spain. And they had come from Lanzarote, which is where he has had his home before and after all of this has happened. I mean, Lanzarote appears to be a place where he feels very safe. He's lived there a long time. And I wonder, is it one of those places that, you know, when you become so familiar with something, you can feel and hear and see things coming because they look out of place.
Yeah.
Even though it's a tourist island, and I'm sure there's an awful lot of strangers' faces on the island a lot of the time in the summer and that. I mean, Gerry Hutch, remember, survived an assassination attempt, he believes anyway, and he has told friends and named the two individuals who he says came from in Lanzarote the New Year's Eve after his nephew Gary Hutch was killed in Spain. And one of the two that he has named, of course, is Cumberton.
Yeah.
Who was jailed.
He's certainly serving a life sentence for the murder of...
What's his first name again?
Eamon Cumberton.
Eamon Cumberton. Yeah. He's serving a life sentence for the murder of Michael Barr in the Sunset House. I think he wore a Freddy Krueger mask when he went into that pub and shot him dead. He was working as a barman, Michael Barr, in front of customers, including a local chap who had special needs and was totally traumatised, and as was everybody else in the pub, for God's sake. So he is wily, you know what I mean? I mean, that night, from what I can piece together on New Year's Eve in Lanzarote, he was out in a pub that he would go to. He was with members of his family, I believe, and he would have told people in the aftermath of that he got a phone call from somebody from somebody from the north inner city looking to meet up, which was unusual slightly. It was an individual they knew, but they wouldn't necessarily have socialized with this person. Yeah. This person seemed very anxious to meet up with them. And so that kind of raised his heckles in the light of what was happening at that stage. And as he was standing in the pub, he's told people he saw these two familiar faces come in from the north inner city.
Yeah, because Eamon Cumberton would have been from the north inner city and would have had associates.
And as was the other individual that he's named. But he saw them come in, and he just, in a split second, made a decision to exit at the back of that pub. And, you know, he is fully convinced they came to kill him and that Daniel Kinahan sent them to kill him. And in a way, that changed everything, didn't it?
It did. It did. I mean, it certainly
changed everything for the Hutch organisation. I think that's when really that plan went into place.
Yeah, I think there was a realisation that it wasn't going to stop at, from the Hutches believed at least, that it wasn't going to stop at Gary, and that the murder of Gary Hutch didn't settle things, that it was going to continue to go.
And because, you see, I think Gerry Hutch is that old school criminal gangland type character that would live by certain rules. Mm. They don't live by the law.
No.
Right? But they live by a certain code. And that old code would have been that, you know, if somebody rats or if they steal money, there are consequences.
Yeah.
And no matter who that person is, there's consequences. So these accusations had been levelled against Gary Hutch. I think, you know, it's fair to say that the monk was brought to bring together Daniel Kinahan and Gary Hutch to try and talk with each other. Whether he remained for those negotiations or hammered out the deal is questionable. He has told people he didn't. He just was the kind of the go-between that they came together to meet. He has told people that Gary Hutch and Daniel Kinahan appeared to have this very deep friendship, that they lived together. They, you know, would have movie nights on a Saturday together in their gymmers, you know, having a cup of tea or whatever, their beers or whatever. They really got on really well. And when they fell out, it was almost like a divorce nearly. Yeah. That they were kind of, certainly Daniel Kinahan appears to have been upset about it at times.
Yeah.
Daniel Kinahan believed that Gary Hutch tried to kill him.
Yeah.
That was the night that Jamie Moore was shot in his garden. He firmly believed at that point that Gary Hutch had come to kill him. And I think that Jerry Hutch's sort of old school thought process on that is, well, if somebody comes to kill you, can you ever trust them again?
Yeah.
If you really genuinely believe that somebody has come and they've tried to kill you, even if they apologize, can you trust them? Or how do you move on from that? So I don't know how he felt about it, but did he think that there was ever going to be peace after that? I don't know. I certainly don't think he expected them to come for him.
No, and I think as well he was probably dragged into it as to give a sort of a status to the Hutch negotiations.
Yeah.
Just the fact that he was maybe one step removed from some of those negotiations, but he was brought in there as a figure
and
of
an older
of
head, really, you know, as well, a figure of respect. I mean, he would insist, Jerry Hutch would insist that he does not know Christy Kinahan Sr. I mean, that all that story was told a number of different ways, never very far removed from each other, but at times it was said that the monk and Christy Sr. got together and hammered out a negotiation. The monk would insist that he never met with Christy Sr., that he only ever met with Christy Sr. at one point years ago when he was in his 20s and Sr. was in his brother Eddie's house because, of course, Sr. and Eddie were...
Well, they were definitely pals.
They were definitely, certainly they worked together.
Yeah.
And Christopher Kinahan Sr., you know, in the early part of his criminal career, he would have kind of got these sort of checks out of Eddie Hutch, you know, what would you call them? Those
traveler's checks.
Traveler's checks and
things
stuff
like that.
And he would have, with his kind of fine manners and his, you know, his posh accent, I suppose, gone and got them cashed. He would have done deals if something was up for offer, had been stolen down the docks or wherever it was stolen, couches, whatever it was, he would have gone and done some negotiations to sell them on.
And of course, like
a fence.
Yeah, Eddie's son, Bouncer Hutch as well, would have been very close to Daniel Kinahan and Christy Kinahan's sons, and would have spent time over in Spain with Christy Kinahan Sr. as well. So that was definitely a big connection. But
that was definitely the connection. But, you know, look, I think he's always insisted, Jerry Hutch, that he didn't meet with Christy Kinahan, that he did meet with Daniel Kinahan and, you know, spoke to him, I think spoke to Gary, and then left them to sort of
work it out.
So, I suppose a role of a mediator in that, and he certainly didn't expect them to come for him, but they did. So, yes, anyway, I think he sort of enjoyed himself for 6 months, and maybe when any of us are relaxing and coming down off a big high or a big, you know, trauma, we will tend to do that. And I think of more recently, people who have seen him said that he's very much trimmed down. He's obviously gone back into a fitness program. He's maybe not allowing himself the ice cream every time he wants one, but is still traveling in and out of the country and basing himself in Lanzarote. I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
He's
like he has enough money to live that lifestyle. I mean,
clearly
he does. Mm. I mean, he's enough. He doesn't have to get a part-time job in McDonald's to fund his trips to Lanzarote.
Well past all that. I mean,
well, how much, how wealthy he is or not is always a matter of debate, isn't it?
It is.
And what about do these friends of his, do they think that his legal issues are at an end? Does he live in fear of the police calling to his door again and maybe there was a lot of talk about investigations into the Hutch organised crime group and any charges that could be brought as a result of that. Certainly, the role of John Spud Murphy, the corrupt ex Garda, that has been discussed in relation to the Hutch gang. Do you think that is?
I don't know how. I don't know what you talk about that.
Yeah.
To people.
Yeah.
That end of it, but I'm sure, given the fact that he was, you know, put on charges of murder, you'd have to be left wary that they would come, the state would come after you again if they had a case against you.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, would you be coming in and out of the country so frequently? I don't know.
I mean, these cases, look, I think they're going to be complicated. Any of those, I suppose, investigations into the operations of organised crime groups, you're not going to find people, sitting in the same rooms as say, a load of drugs, for example, or a load of guns. So they tend to be complicated and involve digital communications and things like that. I don't think it's mysterious to everybody really sometimes as these investigations go on, what's going to be there, and it's never going to be a straightforward.
I would have to say, I think probably Hutch, along with the rest of us, is more focused on what's going to happen next with the Kinahans.
Yeah.
You know, there is this sense of anticipation all the time, isn't there? And I think anyone you speak to, be they in the criminal fraternity or,
just members
more
of the public,
legal, sort of people working in law enforcement, they're all sort of anxiously waiting to see what happens next. And I think there is this sort of universal acceptance that it's going to happen quick.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen and it's going to happen quick. None of us know the time or date except those in the very top of the pile and in charge. But I think you'd be very focused on that. And, I often wonder, how does somebody like Gerry Hutch feel, somebody like his brother Patsy Hutch feel? I know the family blame Johnny Hutch's death, be it accidental, on the Kinahans as well.
Yeah.
And the stress he was under since he survived an assassination attempt with his daughter in the car, who he had collected from her care facility.
Yeah.
And had arrived back to the house, and I think his daughter remained in the car as he was shot at a number of times and just managed to dive into a house and close a bullet-resistant back gate door thing, which saved his life. He later was in Turkey and jumped from a balcony and suffered injuries because he believed somebody was coming for him in the... was there or wasn't there? Who will ever know if there was somebody coming for him or not? Whether there was or wasn't doesn't matter. He believed there was, and that was the way he was living. And that stress, I think the family feel that he is another victim as well of the Kinahans, even though they didn't get him with a bullet.
Yeah.
So, I often wonder, how do they cope with all those emotions you must have? I mean, you must have
anger.
Hatred and anger.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody whose loved one has been shot dead in cold blood and you know who did it. I mean, innocent victims.
Yeah.
And, victims who were caught probably by choice operating in the criminal world. No matter what, they have people who've
100%
suffered huge losses.
Exactly.
How would you feel? I mean...
Well, I mean, I wonder is, exactly. I mean, this is what's driven this feud, I suppose, is that anger on both sides and that desire, I suppose, for revenge, but...
There's very few feuds, I think, you can look back on that you've seen that sort of massacre of...
Yeah. Yeah.
The wider family and friends.
100%. I mean, even you're talking about Johnny Hutch there, even his own son, Jonathan Hutch, was the initial target in while he was on holidays that ultimately ended in the death of an innocent council worker.
That's right. And Gareth Hutch was murdered, other son.
Exactly. So, I mean, the long-term consequences for all of this are absolutely, it's ongoing. I suppose, certainly for Gerry Hutch, that moment where the Kinahans end up being arrested, I suppose, that must seem like something that would maybe be another end point. Whether it will or not, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I think somebody like him, because he's not a total innocent here we're talking about.
No.
the monk. I mean, I don't think he'd ever proclaim himself to be an innocent. But somebody like him understands the world he has operated in and around. He understands that if you do something, the repercussions could be murder.
Yeah.
And he understands that from every side. But I think what happened within the feud crossed that boundary. I mean, there were no rules as to who was being targeted.
No, and I suppose to give the other side, the Kinnahans would say that some of the people would say, or the Kinnahans would say that the Hutches launched the attack first on Daniel Kinnahan. Obviously, instead that Jamie Moore got shot, the boxing trainer in his apartment. They would say that some of the victims were, that we might describe as being totally innocent. They were not as you know, they...
Kinnahan certainly identified a number of the victims as people they believed were involved in the Regency Hotel attack. And we did hear in the court and during the Regency trial, we were able to piece together exactly who the Gardaí also believed were involved. And certainly...
Yeah, I mean, there was movements of cars. Obviously, Eddie Hutch's name was mentioned during the Regency trial. There was no... He was obviously dead, but, you know, from... So the Kinnahans have their...
The Kinnahans believed certainly that Gareth Hutch, that Johnny Hutch and that Eddie Hutch were involved in the movement of cars. They were drivers or something during the attack.
Now, those things didn't get tested in court for the obvious reason that they died.
People aren't alive to defend themselves. But I'm just saying that's what the Kinnahans would say they identified those people as.
Yeah. And if you look back at the book that they sponsored or wrote, the Kinnahans, the online
Blood
book,
Feud.
Blood Feud.
Mm.
So if you read that, like, it's an interesting piece of work, I suppose, in terms of what it says, but a lot of it is a justification for the basically not, it's not to exaggerate it, to call it the massacre of the Hutch family. There's a lot of that book is, you know, this is around that, is a description of why they were justified in doing what they did. There's a big long description of why they believe Gary Hutch was an informer. We don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, they had... So I suppose, are we easy on Gerry Hutch? I mean, one of the things I remember from 1 year ago was when Gerry Hutch walked out, and then in that week after, this kind of goodwill towards him. I mean, an unusual thing maybe, and maybe not. I mean, maybe there's been outlaws through human history that have sort of inspired that goodwill, from the Wild West in the US to, you know, guys in Australia. Like, why does that attach to Gerry Hutch, and is, you know, why does it not attach to Christy Kinnahan? I know there's an obvious reason for that.
I think there's a few reasons that maybe Gerry Hutch had. I mean, there was certainly a sense when he walked out that day and in the aftermath of it. I mean, we said it a number of times, like as if he was loved.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was people beeping their car horns at him. They were up Gerry. There was all sorts of social media postings and all this. And certainly there was this feeling that he'd beaten the system.
Yeah.
And I think that's the first thing, that he had this reputation, always had a reputation. Now, maybe it was a self-made reputation.
Yeah.
You know, he might have pushed it himself.
Yeah.
And there could have been a bit of propaganda going on from the Hutch side over the years as well, that he was this sort of Robin Hood figure.
Yeah.
He was robbing, you know, banks and this sort of thing, and he was really just clawing his way up from the poverty that he had.
An ordinary decent
into.
Criminal.
An ordinary decent criminal he was certainly seen as, right? There's that. Second of all, I think that he has an ability to walk amongst the people.
Yeah.
He's not kind of, like, the Kinnahans did everything wrong from a PR point of view in a way. Even when the younger Kinnahans, the two brothers, returned to the city, they did so in these kind of blacked out cars and surrounded by sort of thugs who were kind of warning people away from them and all this, as if they were kind of like Conor McGregor or some sort of celebrities. And they didn't have the ability, or feel they had the ability, or maybe they didn't have the personality to walk around in the same way that Gerry Hutch has. And I think that made him kind of a little bit more personable maybe to people. I think the fact as well, maybe he's a family man, is something that warms people to him a little bit. And really, his name isn't thrown in there every hand's turn there's a murder.
No.
So do you know, Gerry Hutch's name and the Hutch organization name might be put out a lot about robberies and, you know, and about some serious crime. I mean, Gary Hutch was right up there as a main player in the Kinahan organization. You know, let's be clear about it. Gerry Hutch might have built his reputation on being anti-drugs, but the next generation, Gary Hutch is named in Operation Shovel Files in 2010 as being a lieutenant directly under Daniel Kinahan. So that Hutch organization has certainly become a drugs organization by then. The rest of it, as regards the popularity and all the rest of it, I think he's a marketing department's dream. I don't know what it is, if he could bottle what he has and sell it, because it is a big, it's really rare for somebody who is known and maybe famous or infamous as an organized criminal to be popular.
It is very rare, but not unheard of. I mean, it has happened throughout human history, like Robin Hood, of course, is the criminals always get described as Robin Hood. But I mean, it happened in the Wild West in America, where these outlaws also became kind of celebrities and cultural icons. I mean, I can see from the perspective of the other side how annoying, and annoying is probably a bad word for it, how it makes them very, very angry that Gerry Hutch receives this treatment. I mean, in the judgment in the Special Criminal Court, he is described as the patriarch of the Hutch organized crime group. In their summation, the judges described Gerry Hutch as having at least knowledge of the movement of these weapons and control of these weapons. So it is, you can see it from their perspective as well, how you know, that must be
irritating
to say the least.
Well, especially for the likes of Daniel Kinahan, who's tried so hard for people to like him.
Yeah.
I mean, he has tried his damnedest.
Yeah.
He surrounded himself with certainly people who have spoken up for him, largely from the boxing community, who have, you know, gone out there and done interviews with the media to tell everybody what a great guy Daniel Kinahan is.
Yeah, I mean, famously, Sandra Vaughan, I think, who was the ex head of MTK Global, a Scottish businesswoman, saying how Ireland should be proud of Daniel Kinahan.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that quote in particular. So, I mean, he's made an active effort. He's
made an active effort to be liked.
Yeah.
And I think, actually, funny enough, when you talk to people who know him and who are, I suppose, within his inner circle, they talk about a person who changed, a person who, when he was in Dublin, when he was in Oliver Bond, was, you know, what they'd call a great guy. He was good fun. He was a little bit aloof, but not totally. But I think as he grew up, came of age, moved out to Spain, took over his father's empire, he got this sort of aloofness that, well, it's, look, I mean, the guy is clearly a narcissist, like his own father, and he believes himself to be on an upper plane to others. And I think he can't understand why people don't like him.
I mean, and look, it's a funny thing to discuss, is it really? I suppose public image when you're coming to organized criminals.
Sure.
I mean, it's a unusual. But that's the way it is. I mean, we live in the real world, and even the feud itself has been fought in regards to popularity over social media and all. Like, that is the unusual thing about this feud. That there was also that sub feud in a popularity battle, I suppose. I mean, if you talk to you know, older Gardaí, maybe retired now, it's all, you know, they're scumbags and, you know, they're not. But the public perceive things differently, particularly in the modern world, where the trust in the Gardaí and maybe the trust in journalists, they're all decreasing.
Yeah.
And therefore these people, you know,
Have a voice themselves now.
They have a voice themselves.
They have an ability to create their own narrative and the money to, because they have plenty of people who have paid to put out their social media postings. One thing I do think is worthwhile pointing out, although maybe obvious, I don't think Gerry Hutch's popularity as a criminal with the people of Ireland, let's be, you know, he's not, you know, a guy who invented a machine to help us all live better lives, but his popularity as a criminal, you know, weighing that up with others' popularities as criminals, I don't think that had anything to do with the decision that was made by the Special Criminal Court. I think that decision went down to the lack of evidence against him.
Yeah.
End of.
Yeah, and you could argue, and I think it's a very, and we've said it before, I mean, he was brought on a murder charge. The bar for convicting somebody of murder is, you know, they must be proven to be guilty beyond reasonable doubt. The case that was brought, it's very hard to look at it and not to say there wasn't reasonable doubts there. The evidence was not so conclusive, so overwhelming, which it has to be to get a murder mm-hmm. conviction, that he had to be convicted. And you'd have to look at it and think other charges could have been brought. We've seen other charges regarding conspiracy and facilitation, but they were not before the judges in the Special Criminal Court. It was a straight up murder charge. And, you know, it's impossible to have sat through that and said, for example, Jonathan Dowdle's evidence should have been taken, without doubts.
Yeah.
No, you just couldn't, as a reasonable person, say, I have no doubt he's telling the truth.
I think the other thing about Hutch that I've been told, and by people who are close enough to him, I think that they would know this, that he's this great believer in karma.
Yeah.
You know, in this sort of spiritual karma. Maybe that's all you can do if you've gone through what he has. But it's that belief that karma will come to Daniel Kinahan and is coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd wonder, would members of the Hutch organization, if they knew that Daniel Kinahan was going to be in such and such a pub tonight, would they go in and kill him? I think they would.
You think they would?
I do.
I think
if they had an opportunity, I don't think they have had an opportunity, because he's so far away and safely tucked up in Dubai with all the, you know, the people that he has around him, and he's deep into the social and the political life out there, and he has his protections. But, you know, if he came home to Dublin and he was in a pub tonight, do you seriously think that they wouldn't go back maybe to their, you know, are they going to rely on the system? They have to rely on the system. And maybe that's why you have to believe karma will catch up with them.
Well, I wonder, would they turn up in court if we get a day in court in the Special Criminal Court? Will members of the Hutch family, because of course Daniel is, in theory, the guards are hoping to prosecute him for the murder of Eddie Hutch.
Oh, I think they'll show up in their droves.
So of course, and normally when...
Surprised if they stayed away from that.
Yeah, so I mean, that's what you could face, whatever about gangland charges. But if he was on trial for the murder of Eddie Hutch, would Jerry Hutch be sitting there in the Special Criminal Court looking him in the eye? And, you know, that would be a moment, I have to say.
Well, I can recall when the murder trials relating to Gareth Hutch's murder was happening. And that was a very sort of tense time.
Yeah.
His family were there.
His family were there. But
they
not
were there every day.
Yeah. His sisters and...
Yeah.
And yeah, so look, that would be a moment. And of course, it'd be another incredible moment. Are we going to be sitting here in a few years and watching Daniel Kinahan walk out of the front of the Special Criminal Court after being found not guilty?
Will he be beeped at? And, you know,
I don't know.
Will I be trying to find out how he coped in the aftermath of it? I don't know.
I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. Look, on we go. I mean, we're sort of in this slight little no man's land. There's a little bit of calm now, but I just feel exactly that. I think it's going to kick off again. I think there's going to be movement in Dubai.
Yeah, look, I mean, the guards are over there. And if they would not be over there for this extended period of time with all these contacts, if there was no hope or little hope. So I think they...
And it'll be political as well. I mean, look, you know, won't it be political? You know, it's going to be something that this government are going to want to oversee.
Yeah, I mean, even straight away, Simon Harris is elected a new Taoiseach, and the Kinahans are... He's already speaking about them, you know? So something will happen, I do believe. And I don't think it's going to be...
And Helen McEntee really has been there and at the head, neck and tail of it as Justice Minister. And she remains Justice Minister. And I think she will want to see it out as well.
Yeah.
And of course, Drew Harris was out there speaking at the World Policing Conference or something. And he's quite... lucid about the Kinahans.
Yeah, I think they're definitely for the government, it's become a thing. Actually, there's some internet conspiracy theorists or otherwise, who say every time things are going wrong for the government, they start speaking about bringing the Ginnihans to justice.
Right.
And it has become a thing of a thing that they feel comfortable saying, and they know there's a certain amount of publicity that goes with it. I'm not being cynical about it. I am being cynical about it.
Mm-hmm.
I fully believe that they're absolutely committed to bringing them home as well. But I don't think we'll see at the end of 2024 without something happening.
I wonder, will Gerry Hutch celebrate today? Is it a day?
Well,
you know, a year, an anniversary of the day he walked free. It would have to be. You know, put yourself in his shoes for a minute. It would have to be
a significant
thing that had probably happened in your life.
Yeah, it's a sliding doors moment, as they say. And we can say it's obvious now he was going to be found not guilty. Yeah. But when you're sitting there in the courts, it's always a lottery. Mm. And I have seen cases that I thought, there's no way I'd say, if I was on the jury, I'd say guilty.
Mm.
And they've come back guilty. So, yeah, it's been an interesting year, but yeah. I think it'll get even more interesting.
I think it was certainly will. The next year will prove. Maybe we'll be looking at the other side of this famous
saga.
Okay. Thanks, Niall.
Thanks, Nicola.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Chloe Domini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.